Well, tonight we're beginning a new series of studies, and we've given it the title, Getting to Grips with the Bible. I suppose over the years, I've met a lot of people who have tried to read the Bible, and very soon have found themselves struggling. They've started at page one. That's where you start with most books, isn't it? And they've set off bravely on their trek through the Bible. They've been determined to read it right through. But by the time they've read through the first couple of books, they're really finding it hard going. The language is difficult, especially if they're using an old translation like the Authorized Version. And they find it very hard to make sense of what's happening in some of the stories, because it's all so different from the world we live in, the society, the customs, the way people live their lives is so different from anything we know. And the way of telling the stories is often very different from the way that a modern writer would tell the stories. And then they move on a little in their reading, and they seem to be reading page after page of baffling details. They come to the second half of the second book of the Bible, and that's the book of Exodus. And it's all about a big tent which the Israelites had to make in the desert. And it goes into endless details about the sizes and the shapes and the colours and what sort of skins the curtains had to be made out of. And all the ropes are listed, and the tent posts, and the sockets, and there are long descriptions of all the bits of furniture that are going to go into this tent, and how they've all got to be made, how altars are to be made, and candlesticks, and tables for shewbread, whatever that might be, and instructions for making a mercy seat. Well, what on earth is a mercy seat? You don't get many of those in the Argos catalogue. And most people just find themselves completely lost in all these details. And when they move on to the next book, the book of Numbers, it's even worse. Long lists of all the people who belonged to the different tribes. Who was descended from who? Who begat whom? And, of course, all the names are completely unpronounceable. And then they go on to Leviticus. And it's worse yet again. Endless rules for offering different sacrifices. How you offer a bull, and how you offer a lamb, and when you offer two pigeons, and which sacrifices have to be made inside the camp, and which ones have to be burned outside the camp, and endless detailed rules about all those things. Well, by that stage, most people are simply completely lost. And they're saying, well, what on earth is this all about? And this is about as relevant to me as the workshop manual for a combine harvester. I really cannot see what on earth I am supposed to make of all these details. But beyond all of that, I think that for many of them, the hardest thing of all is this, that they never seem to be able to get hold of where all this is moving. All right, if they press on through Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, yes, they come to some interesting stories, and they come across some useful advice for life, and they come across some wonderful poems about God, and they come to some proverbs that really sum things up. Better to live on the rooftop than to live in the same house as a nagging wife. And they say, yes! Or a beautiful woman with no discretion, it's like a gold ring in the snout of a pig. And they say, yes! But how is all this connected? That's the question. Is there a main thread that runs through all of this different material? Well, yes, there is a main thread running through the Bible. There is a storyline that goes all the way through from the first page to the last. And everything in the Bible has got some part to play in that story. The tent in the wilderness, all those lists of who belonged to which tribe and who begat who, all those rules about sacrifices, all those battles and plagues and invasions, all those poems and proverbs, they all fit into one story. And it's a story that runs through from the first book of the Bible, Genesis, to the last book of the Bible, Revelation. And it's the most wonderful story in the world. Once you've understood the main storyline, you begin to realize that this is the most thrilling, the most mind-blowing story that's ever been told. And the more you read it from that point on, the more amazed you are by the way that all those details which once seemed so irrelevant actually fit in so wonderfully. The wonderful thing about this book is that there is always more to understand. There's always more to see. There's always more to grasp. Some folk have spent 50 or 70 years studying this book, and they still say, I find something new and wonderful in this book every time I read it. And that is certainly my experience. I grew up in a Christian home, as most of you know. I can't remember a time when we didn't read the Bible together as a family. I suppose I could only have been 3 or 4 years old when I started learning passages off by heart. And we would have a time of Bible reading together as a family, and at the age of 3 or 4 I was expected to learn passages off by heart. I guess the first passages I ever learned were Psalm 23 and then Psalm 100. This was the first Bible I myself owned. I think it was given to me on my 6th birthday, but it may have been my 7th birthday. And since then, I've been studying the Bible for half a lifetime. I've been a preacher for nearly 20 years, just preaching on different chapters and verses from the Bible. I guess I've consulted thousands of books that help to explain the Bible. But I still find every time I come to the Bible that I'm discovering something new. Again and again I find myself saying, I never realized that before. Oh, so that's how those two passages link up with one another. Oh, so that's how that story fits in. Oh, so that's what that means. I never realized. You know, somebody lends you a book, and you give it back a week later, and they say, have you read it? And you say, yeah, I finished it. Well, you can never say that about the Bible. You can never say, yes, I finished it. It's nearly 2,000 years since the last part of the Bible was written. People have been studying the Bible for 2,000 years. But we're still seeing things in the Bible that no one has ever seen before. That's one of the proofs that this is God's Word, that it's God's book. The most brilliant scholar in the world, after a lifetime of study, can never say, I understand everything that's in this book. This book is way, way beyond the grasp of any human mind. Only God could have given us this inexhaustible book. It's so much bigger than human intellect. Only God could have woven together this book with its amazing unity. You know, it was written over a period of perhaps 2,000 years or more. The oldest parts of the Bible are certainly 4,000 years old. And as I say, the most recent parts were written just about 2,000 years ago. So you had dozens of different writers who were used to write different sections of the book over a vast period of time. And many of those writers didn't know one another personally. And yet what they wrote all fits together into one amazing story that develops book by book, chapter by chapter, century by century. And the more you study the book, the more you see how perfectly it does all fit together. As I say, when people start reading the book, it just all seems so random and there doesn't seem to be any pattern at all. But the more you read it, the once you've grasped that main storyline, the more amazing the unity actually appears. It's a bit like those 3D pictures, you know, that have become popular in recent years. And, you know, there you have this pattern. Or rather, you can't actually find a pattern. It just seems to be a blur of dots and colours. And you stare at it, and you stare at it, but then you know how you have to focus in on it. And suddenly, it all comes into focus. Suddenly, it's in perspective. And you can see that every one of those dots, every one of those shades is relevant. That there's one picture there behind all the apparent randomness. And that's the way it is with the Bible. When people start reading it so often, they say, well, I just can't see any pattern in it. I can't see how any of this fits together. But then, as they look at it, as they read it, as they pray for God to give them understanding, as they listen to the Bible preached, suddenly they begin to see that, yes, it all has a unity, it all has a single message. It's all telling the same story. So what we're going to do in this series is this. We're going to try to trace out that main storyline. We're going to try to pick out some key events, some key passages, and we're going to look at them, some of the key points in this one unfolding story. We're going to skip over long chunks. We're going to miss out most of those puzzling details because we simply want to isolate the main storyline. And then when we've done that, when you can see that main storyline, well, then you'll be able to spend the rest of your life filling in the gaps. But in this series, it's just that thread that we're drawing out. I'm expecting that most of the sermons in this series are going to be relatively short, because again, I want it to be a series for people who really don't know their Bibles very well, but who want to get to learn how the Bible is to be read. Well, let's turn then to the first book of the Bible, and the first chapter, Genesis chapter 1. We're going to start at the beginning. Literally, the beginning. The beginning of the universe. The beginning of space and time. How does the Bible start? It starts with these words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Bible starts with God. He was already there in the beginning. He is eternal. He is everlasting. Nothing caused God. He simply is and always has been and always shall be. And this God, this perfect, complete, eternal being created the universe, the heavens and the earth. He made the universe out of nothing. Now, God didn't have to create the universe. He did it because he chose to. That's the Bible's starting point. God himself, the measureless, everlasting being who was there when there was no universe. Everything that exists, exists because he planned it. He created it. Everything that exists, exists for him, for his pleasure. It exists for no other reason than because God wants it to exist. Now, when God created the universe, he created it in two parts. You see, in the beginning, God created the heavens, that's one part, and the earth, that's the second part. Let's take the second first. There's the earth. That's this world, the planet we live on. And then everything else is called the heavens, or the skies. Sometimes the word is translated as sky, sometimes the word is translated as heavens. But notice that it's plural, heavens. There are different layers to the heavens in the way that the Bible looks at this. When you look upwards from the earth, you see the sky, don't you? That great blue expanse that stretches from horizon to horizon. Well, the word the Bible uses for that is the heaven. We might be more inclined to talk about outer space, where the distant stars and galaxies are displayed. Well, God created all that. He created all the vast reaches of outer space. In other words, God made the whole material world, not only the earth, but also outer space. Now, we can probe that heaven with our telescopes and our space rockets. But God also made other worlds, worlds which we could never reach with our telescopes and our space probes. He created worlds which are invisible to us. He created a world where angels live and other spiritual beings. And he created a world to be his own dwelling place, his palace, a world more wonderful than we can possibly imagine. And all these worlds the Bible speaks of as the heavens. So the heaven can mean firstly the sky or outer space. It can mean secondly the invisible world where angels and other spiritual beings live. And it can mean thirdly the world where God himself dwells. What I'm trying to make plain is this, that God's creation is infinitely bigger. It is far more wonderful than our minds can possibly take in. Our minds can't even take in the wonders of the earth on which we live, the planet that is our home. We can't begin to understand the complexity and beauty of this earth and the living systems of the earth. Our mind certainly can't begin to take in the vastness of outer space, the first layer of the heavens, and we can't even imagine the glories of those unseen worlds, those heavenly worlds where the angels and where God himself dwells. But it's all God's creation. The visible world, the invisible world, it is all God's. He made all things. He owns all things. He rules all things. So first, God created the heavens and the earth out of nothing. And then this chapter tells us how he shaped the world, step by step. He did it in six stages, 6 days. 6 periods of light, each followed by a period of darkness. Now, we're not going to spend a great deal of time on all the detail, but you'll see that there's a wonderful, orderly pattern in the way that God shaped the world. The earth he had created was empty. It was covered in water. It was hidden in darkness. But God's Spirit was moving in the darkness over the waters. And God spoke, "Let there be light." And immediately the earth was flooded with light. That was the work that God did on the first day. He made the heavens and the earth, and then he made the light shine through the darkness. And then on the second day, he put the sky in place. So there was water below, and there was the sky above. And then on the third day, he made the continents and islands rise up out of the water, so that for the first time there was dry land. And then he covered the dry land with plants and vegetation. Do you see the first three steps? First, he creates the light. Second, he creates the sky and the seas. Third, he creates the dry land. And then he went through the same order again. On the next day, the fourth day, he made the sun and the moon and the stars, the lights in the sky. So day one, light, matches day four, lights. On the next day, day five, he created birds to fly in the sky and fish to swim in the sea. So day two matches day five. Sea and sky, sea creatures and sky creatures. And then on the next day, day six, he made land creatures, insects, animals. And finally on day six, he created man. So day three matches day six, the dry land and the creatures who are going to live on the dry land. And above all, man. Day one matches day four, day two matches day five, day three matches day six. You see the pattern, don't you? God was working to a plan, step by step. But the whole plan was leading up to that marvelous moment when he created the first man. The creation of man was the climax of everything that had gone before. Stage by stage, God was preparing a world for man to live in. And we'll think more next week about man and the way God created man. But tonight I don't want to say too much about man, because it's God we're thinking about tonight. Let me tell you six things about God that this chapter tells us. The first one, we've said it already, God is eternal. In the beginning, God. God was already there in the beginning. Everything else that exists has a cause, but God simply is. Now that may puzzle some people. People have sometimes asked me, but where did God himself come from? Who made God? And sometimes they think they're being clever, and sometimes they're genuinely puzzled. I think the way to look at it is this. Everybody has to agree that if you trace things back far enough, you'll come to something that has no cause, that simply is. If you ask an atheistic scientist, what is the ultimate cause of everything? Where do the galaxies come from? What caused them? He'll probably answer, well, it was all caused by a vast explosion, the Big Bang, which hurled matter in all directions. And then you ask, but what caused that vast explosion? What was there before the Big Bang? And he'll probably say, well, there was a tiny, infinitely dense lump of matter which exploded. And you say, well, what caused that infinitely dense lump of matter? Who made that? And what caused it to explode? And he says, nothing. It had no cause. And there was nothing that caused it to explode. You see, he believes in something eternal. He believes in something that had no beginning and no cause, but which caused everything else. But his something is just a lump of infinitely dense matter. Well, which is easier to believe? That this fantastic universe, with all its complexity, all its beauty, with its wonderful set of exact physical laws, and with all the intelligent beings in it, was caused by an impersonal lump of infinitely dense matter, or that it was caused by a perfectly wise, totally powerful, eternal person? Could a lump of mindless matter really have caused all of this? And once you put it in that way, well, it answers itself, doesn't it? We all know, deep down inside, that the eternal cause of this wonderful world must be personal. There must be a thinking, planning, creative self who is the ultimate cause. Not an it, but a he. And the Bible calls him God. He's eternal, the uncaused cause of all that is. The second thing I want you to see, he's almighty. He has to be if he's eternal. And if he created all things. Everything else that exists, exists only because he wants it to exist. So by definition, nothing can challenge him or threaten him. If he made all things, he could unmake them again, if he chose to. He's not part of the universe. He's outside the universe. He was there when there was no universe. So he is there in control of the universe. He shapes it. He upholds it. He rules it. Everything in this chapter talks, doesn't it, about the almighty power of God. He's only got to speak, and his will is done. Let there be light. And there is light. The oceans, the mountains, the continents, they're all his. He's in control of them all. We talk about the forces of nature, but they're his forces. And he uses them to accomplish his purposes. This chapter shows us God in control of every part of creation because he made it all. Then the third thing. God is wise. God is wise. We've seen already that God plans. The universe was not made by random chance. It was not made even by a God who just did things randomly. Oh, let's try this out. Let's see how this would look. You know, there are some modern artists who try to produce paintings by random chance. Just throw the paint at the canvas and see what happens. And what mostly happens is a mess. But that wasn't the way God created. The world that he created was exactly the way he planned it. Down to the last detail. When you read through the chapter, you see how perfectly orderly it all was. We stressed that when we looked at the pattern of the 6 days, didn't we? And you can see it all the way through. Do you see in verse 11? He made the plants, the trees, all bearing fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. Verse 21, he created the sea creatures and the birds according to their kinds. Verse 24, he creates the land creatures according to their kinds. It's all so systematic, isn't it? Biologists map out the different classes of living creatures and the different genera, the species. And they can show which creatures have what percentage of DNA in common with one another. And they can map out all this. But it was God, in his wisdom, who made all those creatures according to their kinds. It was God who designed the map. Fourthly, God is a God of beauty. God filled his world with such a variety of wonderful, beautiful, delightful, fascinating things. We're filled with awe when we look up at the night sky, when we see the stars set in that velvety blackness. God made it beautiful beyond words. God made the tiniest flower in all its delicacy. God made the sunset with its astonishing colours, which even a Turner couldn't reproduce. And God made magnificent tigers. And God made spindly-legged deer. And God made multicoloured fish. God made a world infinitely full of colour and variety. I've said it before, haven't I? The world didn't have to be colourful, you know. God could have created human eyes and human brains so that they could only see shades of black and white. But God made us to see the whole spectrum of colour for our delight. God could have created just one sort of food, couldn't he? We could be like cows, just living off grass and never knowing any other taste. But God didn't. God created an amazing range of different foods with different tastes and different textures. Because God is a God of infinite variety and infinite beauty. Fifthly, the fifth thing I want to say about God. God is kind. God is kind. You see in this passage that when God has created all these different creatures, he cares about them. He's not just an experimenter who produces all these different things and then takes no more interest in them. You remember the myth of Frankenstein, the scientist who, just as a exercising curiosity, really, produces this strange creature, but then really doesn't have any further interest in it then. He doesn't feel any sense of responsibility for it. But the God of the Bible isn't like that. Having made all this amazing variety of creatures, he really cares about them. You see it in verse 22. God has created the birds in the sky, and he's created the fish in the sea. He's created shellfish. He's created oysters. He's created mussels. He's created octopi. He's created plankton. And he cares about them. It says this, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas. Imagine this great God who could call the whole universe into being, this God who only has to speak and the immeasurable energy of light floods the universe. This God now looks down at the plankton in the water and speaks words of blessing over them. You're my creatures, and I care about you, he says. That is the extraordinary tenderness of God towards all that he has made. And then one last thing that we see here in this chapter about God. God is holy. One of the phrases that comes again and again and again in these verses. It's almost the chorus, the refrain that runs through this chapter. You see it in verse 4. God saw that the light was good. Verse 10. God called the dry ground land and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Verse 12. End of the verse, he's created the trees and the plants, and God saw that it was good. Verse 18, God has set the sun and the moon and the stars in the sky, and God saw that it was good. And you have the same thing in verse 21 and in verse 25. At every point, God is examining what he's made. He's judging it. He's assessing it to see whether it meets his perfect standard. He wants to ensure that everything in his creation is as perfect as he himself is. This God is not indifferent to the creation he's made. He is concerned as to whether it is good. Now, as it leaves the hand of God, it is all perfectly good. He assesses it, he judges it, and he can say, yes, it's good. This is a God for whom there is a real difference between good and evil, between right and wrong. This is a God who must judge, who must assess. You know, in modern philosophy, which is filtering through into the whole of our society, people are being taught that there is no such thing as absolute good or absolute evil. They are being told that there's no such thing as absolute right or wrong or truth or falsehood. They say, well, it's all a matter just of what you feel or how you think or circumstances. It all changes with different societies and different situations. But there's no such thing as absolute good. And this chapter tells us that that's a lie. Because God looks at everything he's made. And he is always looking to see, is this perfectly good? Does this match my own perfection? God is a God who is holy and who demands that everything in his world shall match his own goodness. There then is the God of Genesis 1. And this God creates everything very good. Now let me just say this. All of you, I'm sure, are aware of the modern theory of evolution. The theory which says that life on Earth began with a very simple single-cell creature which came into being by chance, and that creature over many millions of years evolved into more complex creatures, and ultimately man himself has evolved from those primitive beginnings. Well, it is impossible to square that idea with what we have here in Genesis 1. And I'll tell you why. The world that God made was a world that was perfectly good. We've been told that again and again and again. It was a world without suffering. It was a world without conflict. It was a world in which there was no death. Animals in that world didn't devour one another. If you look at verse 30, you see there that God commanded every beast of the earth to eat only plants. Now, the whole theory of evolution assumes that from the very beginning of life on Earth, there has been suffering, competition, conflict, and death. That is the whole mechanism, supposedly, by which evolution functions, that weaker creatures are destroyed or are made redundant, and fitter creatures survive. And Genesis 1 says, absolutely no. The world that God created was perfect from the beginning. It was a world in which creatures did not have to fight for survival. It was a world in which creatures did not compete with one another and devour one another and die in pain. It was a world without disease. It was a world without landslides that buried creatures. It was a perfect world when it left the hand of God. That is the great conflict between what the Bible has to say and what unbelieving scientists say today. The Bible makes it absolutely plain that the God of the Bible is perfectly good, and that the world as made by God was a world of perfect goodness. There then is Genesis chapter 1. It sets us the scene. All we've done looking at Genesis 1 is to set the scene, isn't it? I said there's a single storyline that runs all the way through the Bible. Well, now the scene is set. The stage, as it were, is set for the story to begin. But what I want to say finally is this. Who is the story about? The story that is going to be worked out on this stage. Who is the story about? And we've answered that question tonight, haven't we? The story is God's story. The principal character in the Bible story is God himself. He was there in the beginning. He was the one who created and planned and designed. He is the one who controls. God himself is the principal story, the principal character in this story. We like to think that history is all about man, about the human race, about our achievements. But no, history, from the Bible's point of view, is not chiefly about man. History is about God. It is from God, and it's through God, and it's for God. God himself is the one we're going to be looking at as we trace out the Bible story. We're going to be seeing what God does. We're going to be seeing God's plans worked out step by step. We're going to be seeing this God who created the world having dealings with the world. This is the story of God. History is his story. Well, I trust that as the book develops, as we move on in our reading of this wonderful, wonderful book, I trust that our eyes are going to be open to see more of God. That is the goal, isn't it? Not just that we're going to learn about a fascinating book, but we're going to be learning about God, the one who is both the author and the subject of the whole story. We're praying that God will draw us to himself as we study this book together. May he speak to us tonight through his holy and infallible word.